always difficult to find one's own defilements. It's easy enough to think about them in abstract, to acknowledge that yes, we have these qualities in our mind that cause suffering. Although even that seems to be difficult for some, I think there's a level of realization or wisdom that it takes to actually acknowledge this. I've heard even people in Buddhism that have objected, they don't like the word defilement. They think it's too ugly. Apparently in German, the German translation of the Pali word kilesa is something like in the English, clouds in the heart. So clouds in the heart may be a more gentle rendering of kilesa or asava, or these words we have for defilement. So although one might want to seek for a more gentle word for these things, it's good to remember that if we think of all of the evil which has been perpetrated by humanity in the history of our species, that all of it has been perpetrated by these defilements. If we think about the destruction in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, think about the concentration camps in Auschwitz, we think about the rape of Nanking, think about all of the murders and rapes and atrocities and genocides that have been committed by people pretty much like you or I. Then we start to get an appreciation of what this thing called defilement is and why it's appropriate to use quite a strong word for these things. They're not just some kind of thin little wispy cloud that happens to blow across the heart now and then. It's something much deeper than that, much more fundamental. It's quite shocking how easy it is for us to cause pain to others. There was a very famous psychological experiment done in the 1960s where the psychology professor set it up. So you had an experiment, her name was Minden or something, I can't remember what it was now. And he set up the experiment so that you have people come in and they're told, okay, that there are two kinds of subjects in this experiment. One is called a teacher and one is called a learner. Now this is just a lie. Actually, the learner is part of the experiment and only the teacher is the actual subject of the experiment. And so this person who's called a teacher has to try to teach the meanings of certain words to the learner. And then every time they get one wrong, an answer to a question wrong, they have to press a button which gives them an electric shock. And the electric shock starts out very mild at about 40 volts. And when they start out, the teacher is given a sample. So the professor who's actually running the experiment gives them a sample and shocks them at 40 volts and says this is like the shock that you're giving in the initial stages to the learner. And as it goes on, then the shock will get greater and greater. And so they run the experiment, and of course the learner has to make a certain amount of mistakes because the learner, of course, is part of this. They're in separate rooms. They can't see each other. But as the shock gets greater and greater, the voltage is increased, and the learner starts to protest or starts to yell. And by the end of it, the voltage, supposed voltage, of course there are no electric shocks, it's all just a fake, but the supposed voltage goes up to 450 volts. Which is double the voltage that you get from a power point in Australia. If any of you have ever, like myself, have ever actually experienced a shock from a power point in 250 volts, you know that it is extremely painful and very powerful. And to be giving almost twice that amount is called a lethal shock. And by the end of it, the learner is screaming in pain, bashing against the wall and crying out and pleading to be released and to not go on. And the professor who's governing the experiment tells the teacher, who's the real subject, oh yes, this is perfectly normal, please proceed with the experiment. And the purpose of the experiment was to find out how many of people who put in the teacher's role would actually go through with that. And they found out to their shock that almost everybody would continue right up until 450 volts. And even if they questioned, when they started hearing the people screaming and bashing on the wall and begging to not be shocked, even if questioned like that, then they would still continue if the professor reassured them that everything was perfectly normal and that they had to continue to complete the experiment. So this was a very famous, if not notorious, experiment that was done in the 1960s. One of the questions raised by the experiment was, you know, the extent to which we would choose to subjugate ourselves to authority. Another question raised by it was how ethical it is to treat experimental subjects in that way, and that there was concern about whether the people who were doing the shocking were actually traumatized by it. But what they actually found out later was, when they interviewed the subjects of the experiment later on, that many of them actually found the experiment to be quite extremely beneficial, because they actually learnt about themselves to what extent that they were able to inflict pain on others. So this is a very, very important thing to consider. Again, this is how the defilements work. In that case, the defilement isn't even hatred. We're not inflicting pain out of any hatred or anger for that person, but it's sheer delusion. This is another one of the defilements. It's delusion which is causing us to cause this pain. And it's very difficult to overestimate the power and the strength of this delusion. And that's even more emphasized by a recent experiment which has replicated this, but in a very strange way. What they've done now is they've done the same experiment, but with computers. So you have like a computer image of somebody, and you have to shock that person, okay, so give them an electric shock, but it's only a computer program. And you know that it's only a computer program. The experimenter tells you at the beginning of it that there's no human being there, this is only a computer, and when you shock them, the person on the screen, their face will look as if they're shocked, but it's actually only a computer-generated image. And so you know that very well. And what they found out when they tested people like this, in conditions similar to the original experiment, that actually the same kinds of emotional reactions, people had the same kinds of emotional reactions, and about the same percentage of people refused to continue with the experiment as had done in the original experiment. So whether you think that you're shocking a real human, or whether you know that you're shocking just a computer-generated image, doesn't really affect the results of the experiment. So this is quite powerful and quite disturbing kind of thing to consider, that how we think that we're compassionate. We think that we take account of the feelings of others. We think we like to think of ourselves as kind people, as people who are considerate. But how much are we really acting in a compassionate way? How much are we really training ourselves to put ourselves in the shoes of those other people? And how much are we acting out of our own defilements when we're treating others and treating others and causing them pain? So this is why we should never underestimate the power of defilements. We should never underestimate the power of our own greed, hatred, and delusion. These things can and will cause us to cause great grief and pain and agony to ourselves and others. This is why the Buddha in the Sabbasava Suttas constantly repeating the refrain, Asava Vighata Parilaha, the vexation and fever of defilements. The vexation and the fever of defilements. And this is what is being brought up and caught up in ourselves. If we are feeling this vexation, if we are feeling this fever, then we know this is caused by those defilements. It's not caused by anything else. And we are inducing this, causing pain to others because of our own defilements as well. So this is a very, very important thing to remember in especially the development of compassion. And so when we want to try and understand this thing, compassion, compassion, com means with, passion is the feeling. So feeling with somebody, this is what compassion means. In Pali, the word anukampa is similar. Anu means along, kampa means to tremble or shake. So anukampa means to shake together with, to shake along with, to shake alongside with. And this is what compassion is all about, that the ability to put oneself in somebody else's place, not to feel how we think about that person, which is just a projection of our own concepts and ideas and views and opinions, and this is just more self, but to be able to put aside the self, to be able to not see things from one's own perspective, but to be able to actually feel, what is that person feeling like? How is it actually like for them? What is going on with that person? Why is this person, you know, compassion is especially relevant when we see people feeling pain. And so when we see people around us who are unhappy, who are stressed, who are sad, then compassion is what wants to understand that. Oh, why is that? Not to be judging or trying to solve problems. Compassion doesn't want to solve problems. It doesn't want to tell somebody, this is what's wrong with you and this is what you have to do about it. But compassion is what's able to actually just feel. What is that? What's going on? And so in this way, compassion is an awareness practice. It's a practice of understanding. It's a practice we have to actively use our mind. We have to actively do it as a practice. We can't just expect it to happen to us automatically. We have to actually make a practice of this, make a constant practice of it, to be not thinking, what's good for me? What do I want? What do I need? Me, 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 me. You know, this person did that to me. This is unfair for me. I shouldn't have to do this. I don't like this. This is not right for me. And so we're always thinking like this. So we have to put these thoughts aside. And Buddha called these kinds of thoughts like lamentable thoughts. We put these aside. And we think about the other person. Why are they like that? What's driving them? What's motivating them? And so we can actually feel the sense of, oh, okay, you know, this is what's going to be causing pain for them. This is what we're going to be causing sorrow and agony for them. And so it's not a matter of judging it, because we've all got our stuff. We've all got our things which are going to cause us sorrow and pain. Some of us maybe more than others. Some of us are happier than others. Some of us more equanimous with things. Others get very emotional about things. This is just the difference in people, difference in individuals. And there's no, you know, we shouldn't be going around judging or comparing, because actually when you get to know people and get to know different people better, and you're practicing this compassion, then the more you start to realize, well, that these different ways of reacting and responding and so on, each of them has their own qualities, their own values, which is sometimes good, sometimes bad, sometimes valuable, sometimes painful, and so on. And so it's not easy to make blanket or simplistic judgments about these things, but just being aware of it, putting aside our own self-centered point of view and putting ourselves in the shoes of others and being able to feel those things, it's a very beautiful practice. And so these if we don't do this, if we don't make a habit of this, if we don't make a strength of this, then we'll fall back to that default setting, we'll fall back to the normal characteristic, which is to be under the sway of defilements. It's not to say that people, generally speaking, are normally under the sway of defilements, to the greater extent. In fact, I don't believe that that's true. I believe that in our human society, that we are characterized mainly, in fact, by reasonable or kind or compassionate interactions. And the reason that we notice unkind and uncompassionate actions is because they're relatively rare. And so this is, you know, what we see, for example, in the news media, where, you know, they'll pick out a story. Somebody gets murdered in the city. Someone in Sydney's been murdered today. Well, of course, 4 million people have not been murdered today, but that doesn't make the news. And so it's filtered out, and we present one day one person gets murdered, and another day another person gets murdered, another day another person gets murdered. And so if we watch the news, we think that, oh, there's so much murder happening in the city. And we forget that there's actually now 3,999,997 people who've not been murdered. And we ignore those things and we think how much murder there is. And so this is how media works. And in working that way, this is not the fault of the media. The media is just reflecting how our minds work, that we tend to filter out that normal, everyday kindness and consideration that we display for each other. And, you know, we live in a society where if we want to observe these things, then we can see them all around us. When I gave a talk at the Indonesian Buddhist Society, the new place in just a warehouse complex. There's a center there in the warehouse complex, and I went to the toilet there, and on the toilet it had markings for the men and women toilets in Braille. I thought, oh, isn't that nice? That was the first time I'd ever seen that. You had the little markings in Braille so that blind people could find out which toilet they should be going to. So I thought that was very nice. It's a very sign of a thought of kindness in somebody that they were able to do that, to put that there. So if you want to look for that, then we can always find those things. But these kinds of structures are maintained with effort. They're things that we have to learn. They're things that are part of our growing up, part of the normal development of our psychology, that we have to learn these things. And we have to keep going with that, otherwise we'll regress. And so we need to keep on aspiring to look at those people who have developed these qualities to a very profound degree. People like, for example, Mahagosananda, who passed away recently, and who's developed these kinds of qualities of compassion to a quite incredible degree, and many others who have managed to do this. It's not impossible. And it starts out with just a little thing. It starts out with just that little thought of others, so that we move towards that thought of others and thought of giving, thought of sharing, thought of giving up, thought of helping, thought of just selflessness and humility, rather than all of those thoughts of getting or me or mine and so on. And you know, be very careful. We have to be very careful, like in the Sabbasava Sutta, and one of the things that it points to is the difference in different kinds of defilements and the difference in different kinds of ways of dealing with those defilements, that there's not one blanket solution to all of these things. And actually there was a very famous dialogue in the history of Tibetan Buddhism. Early on in Tibetan Buddhism, I can't remember the exact dates, but one time the king didn't know which kind of Buddhism to adopt, and they had Buddhist missionaries simultaneously arrived in Tibet, both from China and from India. And the Chinese mission was teaching an early form of Chan Buddhism, and it was emphasizing on this kind of teaching of the original mind, just be aware, and then that's all you need. And then the Indian representative from the Madhyamaka school was teaching that, you know, you needed to have a whole detailed variety of different methods to cope with different kinds of problems. And that the Buddha taught so many different methods and different skillful means to deal with different situations. And the Chinese monk was arguing, no, yes, but that's true that the Buddha did teach those different things, like different medicines for different diseases. But that also, his argument was that there's a special kind of medicine, which is a universal medicine, and you can take that for every kind of disease. This was his argument. And in the same way, by just that practice of bare awareness and just knowing, just the practice of mindfulness is enough to solve everything. And so this was the very significant debate in the history of Tibetan Buddhism. And as we know from what happened in the history, the Tibetans chased the Chinese out. One might suspect there maybe were political implications involved in this as well. But according to the histories, it was a Dhamma-based argument. So the Chinese were chased out and the Indians were successful. And so the Tibetan Buddhism was missionized from India rather than from China. And this is how that happened. And so they accepted the doctrine that the Buddha taught different kinds of solutions for different kinds of problems, different medicines for different diseases. And so this is the kind of thing that which is taught in the Sabbasava Sutta and many other places. So we need to look at what kinds of diseases, kinds of defilements we are experiencing in our particular situation, because in different situations we're going to experience these things in very, very different ways. And here I'm sitting, I'm an abbot, supposedly, and a Dhamma teacher and all of these kinds of things, and so I have the defilements that's appropriate for an abbot and a Dhamma teacher and everything. It's not that I get rid of my defilements because I do these things. And so I try to be aware of these kinds of defilements. For example, As all of you know, I've done quite a lot of study and I have a very good memory, and whether or not I have any insight into the Dhamma, I don't know, but I certainly have a reasonable kind of intellectual grasp and understanding of the Dhamma. So of course then that causes a kind of conceit, doesn't it? That causes me to think, well, I know the answer and other people don't, and because I know the suttas better than most other people that I meet. So, you know, you tend to be a bit dismissive, or that's the tendency, is to become dismissive or to not really listen to other people's perspectives. And of course that's a very deep problem, because as soon as you start being like that, then you can't learn anymore. And so it may be the case that most of the time, if I'm talking with people about the suttas, the simple fact is I do know more than most people. But that doesn't mean I can't learn from other people, and I should still be trying to be as open and learning as much as I can. And so this is a kind of defilement which I notice in myself, and which I try to overcome as an abbot or as a Dhamma teacher. Other things which I've talked about also, which I think are problems for somebody in my position, you know, like to somehow expect a degree of respect or something like this, is to think that because I'm an abbot, therefore people should treat me in a certain way. And also these kinds of defilements are things I try to deal with, try to overcome, and try to work with that situation of actually doing the role as best as I can without succumbing to these kinds of problems. And just reflecting that, of course, you know, this is just a role that I play. Being an abbot or being a teacher or anything is nothing. It's not me. It's not actually who I am. It's just a role that I play to try to serve the community for a period of time. And maybe in the future I won't be doing this or something. Maybe some of you will be doing similar roles and maybe doing it much better than I can. And so there's no sense in which there's anything particularly special about it. It's just a kind of role which I take up for a period of time. So these are some of the kinds of defilements that I have to deal with as an abbot. Another one is the whole question of power. And it's not something easy, because on the one hand then you need a decision making and an ability to do things in a monastery. So, you know, we need a process whereby decisions can be made, can be acted on, and done in a proactive way. And personally, I can't abide situations where everything gets, tiny decisions get bound up in useless committees and all of these kinds of things. And so there has to be a clear and proactive decision-making process and a leadership process. But on the other hand, then, that still has to be like a listening to others and to the voice of the community, because everybody of course lives here. We all share this community together. It's not any one person's thing. And so this is an ongoing issue. It's not one which I think there's a one final solution for, but it's one that we try to manage as best we can. So these may be some of the kinds of defilements that I face as a teacher or as an abbot, which I try to deal with as best I can, sometimes consciously, sometimes unconsciously. And each one of you will have your own kinds of defilements, your own kinds of problems. The nuns will have their own nuns' problems, the nuns' defilements that you have to look at, you have to kind of deal with in this situation. And that we're starting a monastery where we're trying to encourage and support nuns as much as we can. And then this causes various kinds of issues to come to the surface, like the kind of the social role of nuns and how they relate with the monks in the community and how we do things in terms of the etiquette and all of these kinds of things. Also causes more deep or more important issues of one's own self-image and one's own sort of feeling of like who am I and what am I doing here? Am I, you know, this person who's actually here, living here and now, or am I actually feeling pain and actually trying to overcome the pain and trying to develop my understanding and compassion? Am I actually this person, or am I the representative of an idea? And so if we say we're going to be supporting bhikkhunis, am I a bhikkhuni? Is that just a generic label for a thing that I am? Or am I actually this human being who actually lives inside this skin? These are the kinds of questions we need to look at. And so the various kinds of defilements and problems that we see around these kinds of things. And, you know, for the monks, for the bhikkhus, also their own kinds of problems that they need to be very careful of. Be very careful of having a conceit because of your status as bhikkhus. Be very careful of getting a sense of pride that you think that you're better than anybody else because you're a bhikkhu. You're not. You're better or you're worse than anybody else because of the extent to which you've developed your mind and developed wholesome qualities and abandoned unwholesome qualities. This is all that counts. Everything else is just social conventions. It's not important. And so never get the feeling that people shouldn't treat monks in this way. Monks shouldn't be respected like this or like that, and that's not appropriate, blah, 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 and all this kind of rubbish that I hear from monks from time to time. Not very commonly, and I have to admit, not the monks who are here at the moment. I haven't heard these things. I'm not scolding anybody. I'm just giving some ideas of the kinds of things which can be problems for monks. Remember that if we want respect, like real respect, you know, there's this kind of fake respect that you get, you know, you bung a robe on and then everyone will come and bow to you. Well, it's a kind of fake respect. But there's a real respect which people give when they see, like, why do people really respect you? Why is there a real kind of respect? The real respect comes when people see, how do you cope with difficulty? How do you cope with trauma? How do you cope when things get really hard and really tough? When you're really put under pressure, when you're put under stress, how do you deal with that? This is where respect will come from. And this is why, you know, if I was to hop on an aeroplane to fly from Sydney to Perth, well, no one's going to respect me for that. I just sit in a seat and have people give me cups of coffee. That doesn't, no big deal of respect there. But, you know, if I was to walk across from Sydney to Perth, then people would respect that. And so this is, and if I was the first one ever to walk from Sydney to Perth, across the trackless desert, not knowing where I was going, then people would really respect that. So this is where respect comes from. How do we triumph? How do we overcome that which is difficult and that which is problematic? So we should never be demanding or expecting respect. This is just defilement, sheer, complete defilement. There's no skerrick of Dhamma in there at all. There's nowhere where the Buddha or in the Vinaya justifies or supports monks or nuns who are wanting others to treat them with respect and to try to say that this is something that you should be developing and that you should want. Quite the opposite. The Buddha's statement on it, please always remember in your lives as monks and nuns, Darunu ayam bhikkhave labha sakkara siloko. Dreadful monks are gains, honors and fame. Dreadful, daruno. This is such a strong word that it's rarely found elsewhere in the suttas. Dreadful, awful is this thing's gains, honors, and fame. And especially for monks and nuns, this is going to be one of our greatest obstacles. And it's so awful because it creeps up on us. It creeps up on us unsuspecting until we find that we're saying things that We it's almost unbelievable when we actually take it and put it into the hard light of reality. And some of the things that I've heard from other monks, you know, and, you know, things like basically that, you know, we should not do anything to upset rich lay women because that's what we do and because that's what, you know, the Sangha survives. So even though we know that sometimes these rich lay women, I say lay women only because this is the example of different cases that was actually involved here, not because I think lay women are any worse than lay men, but that they do all kinds of things which are completely inappropriate and unethical. But, you know, our responsibility, our duty as Sangha is to just basically indulge them and to not get them upset. This is what I've been told by one of the senior monks in our tradition, and this, I don't believe this at all. I don't think our relationship with anybody should be based on principle, should be based on Dhamma and on Vinaya, not on how wealthy they are. And if somebody's behaving in a way that's inappropriate, then we need to respond to that behavior appropriately, not by just trying to make excuses to somebody because of their wealth. And so this is, These are the kinds of things which creep up on us as monks and which we don't notice and which gradually colour and taint our holy life until we kind of forget what the purpose of it was in the beginning. And so it's very, very important. This is how these defilements work. They're so innocuous, they're so hard to see. When we saw Lumpur Panyawado years ago, he talked about this. He gave this very simple, very beautiful example. He said, you know, it's like you're walking down a street and, you know, you're just walking down the street and you see a TV set, television set for sale in the window of a shop. You don't think anything of it. You just notice this, you walk on by. You get back home and then, you know, maybe having a cup of tea or whatever you're doing, and then the thought to you comes to you, oh, no, that was quite a nice set, that wasn't it? Yeah, TV set wasn't such a bad TV set, you know. I wonder what the price of it was, or something like that. And then that thought just comes and goes, just very innocuously, you know, just like nothing. It's just a little thought. It's nothing. It's just this tiny little thought that comes into your mind, like a thousand other thoughts that come in and out of your mind every day. But it gets that little hook in there. And then the next day you think of it again. And the next day you think of it again. And then you find yourself walking past that same shop again and then stopping in the window, looking at it more and more. And then you walk into the shop and talk to the salesman about it and you end up buying the TV set. And you get it home and you realize actually it wasn't nearly as good as you thought it was going to be. It's how desire works. It's how our defilements work. They get that little, tiny little hook in there so that we don't notice it, so that we don't realize it. And the more and more it gets in, then the more hard it becomes for us to recognize it and to get it out. The easier it becomes for us to justify. And one of the very sad things that we see sometimes is that, of course, if we are living in a sangha setting, a monastic setting, we get used to using Dhamma language, we get used to using Buddhist language and vocabulary and so on, and then it becomes easy, it becomes natural for us to justify our defilements using Dhamma language, using Vinaya language. And we can take these words and these ideas and then use them in entirely inappropriate ways, twist them around and apply them in ways that can actually bring about the exact opposite of what the original intention was. So this is why we need this eternal vigilance against these defilements. We need to be very honest with ourselves, very sincere with ourselves, to recognize these things really as they are, recognize the ugliness of them, recognize that yes, they are defilements, that even a little bit of them is dangerous, to recognize them very quickly and to be able to overcome them, and to also to acknowledge to ourselves that in order to overcome them at a deep level, we need to energetically and persistently develop the opposing qualities, develop those techniques which are going to help us to overcome those things. So we develop compassion to overcome the cruelty. We find that we're getting lost in sensual objects, and we need to develop the restraint of the senses and so on and so forth. So all of these are like medicines for particular illnesses, and they will help us. Never don't think that just one medicine is going to cure all the illnesses. This is not the case. So this is my talk for you this evening on the defilements and various aspects and reflections on the defilements. And I offer that to you for your reflection, and I'd like to invite any comments or questions. Okay, there's no more questions. We'll finish by paying respects.
Bhagavato sarvaka sangho sanghinam.